Hi lovelies, it's just Caitlin here jumping in before the start of today's episode to bring you all a quick announcement. So I've been working on this podcast for like months now and uploading for 3 months, and in that time I've realised that I've let the podcast, which I love and I am so, so proud of, sort of take over everything, and I've been neglecting my other social media platforms. If you only know me from my podcast, I also post true crime content over on my TikTok account, which I have been totally neglecting since the start of this podcast. And I don't want to do that because I love my TikTok account. That's where I initially started my true crime telling. So I've decided that moving forward from today, I am going to be uploading the podcast fortnightly as opposed to weekly, just to help us manage posting equally across all different places and not to feel pressured if I have like a busy week where I can't be researching or recording a whole lot. Some of you may or may not know that I do have a son. I have an autistic son. So that means some days I cannot get onto my computer and do research when I want to. And some days, after really long days, I am just way too tired. And then there's things like school holidays and stuff like that, which I won't bore yous with, but yous get the gist. I just want to be really consistent posting here, and I don't want to feel like I'm letting yous down if I'm having to take weeks off, like here, there and everywhere at unexpected times. So I hope that yous all understand. I know that yous will, and I'm not going to ramble on any further. I'm just going to leave it at that. So from today, it will be fortnightly episodes, and hopefully we can get back up to weekly in the future. So let's jump in to today's episode. Hello lovelies, my name is Caitlin and welcome to another episode of True Crime with Caitlin. Today we're going to be talking about a case which was recommended to us through my case recommendation form. So if you have any cases that you want to hear me cover, please go ahead and fill that out. The link is in the description of this episode and also in the link tree. I do regularly check it, and as this episode proves, I will try and cover all of them. So today's episode is about a man who dubbed himself the Angel of Mercy. This is serial killer Andrew Dawson. On the 13th of August 1981, Ormskirk police in Lancashire received a worrying call. The day before had been market day in the little town, and now a pedestrian is noticing that the back gate and door of the local hardware shop are both open, potentially looking like someone had broken in. Market day in Ormskirk sees people coming in from all of the surrounding towns to have a gander at some of the 100 stalls stretched across three different streets. Two police officers arrived at the yellow hardware shop on Moore Street and made their way down the alley alongside it. The hardware shop was said to have been stuck in the 50s. It was run by an older man who didn't update it at all. He liked it just how it was, and he didn't have like a huge array of stuff in there, so officers were quite confused that someone would pick this place to rob from. They walked in through the open gate and door, making their way into the shop. And this is when they would discover the body of 91-year-old Henry Walsh. Henry was a happily married father of two who had owned and ran the hardware shop for as long as anyone could remember. He was described as a lovable, timid, pleasant old man who would make time for anyone. He was a staple in the small town, a friendly face that everyone recognised, as when he wasn't serving customers or stood behind the till, he would be leaning up against the doorframe of the shop, chatting to anyone and everyone as they strolled past. When Henry's body was discovered, it was plain as day that he had been the victim of a callous killing. He had been hung up on court hooks over the back of a door, almost as if his body was on display. Henry's injuries would be compared to torture. He had been struck across the face with so much force that his jaw was fractured. He had a ligature tied around his neck. He had been savagely stabbed with a carving knife, one of the stabs being delivered with so much force that it had completely gone through his body and was embedded in the door behind him. Henry also had several other slicing wounds where the killer had pierced him with the knife. Inside of the shop, there were signs of a struggle, proving that Henry had been ambushed. The only things that were noted to have been stolen were the days taken from the till, along with Henry's pension book, which didn't total up to a lot. This made it clear to the officers that robbery slash monetary gain was the motive behind this horrific murder. Lancashire Police began a murder inquiry and tried their best to keep information as close to the chest as possible. However, reporters broadcasted every detail that they could get their hands on. A brutal murder such as this wasn't a common thing in Ormskirk, and so it was the headline of every newspaper and every news channel at the time. After a few days of not really progressing anywhere with the investigation, police decided to use this media coverage to their advantage. They posted a press release asking anyone to come forward if they had any information. The leads began to trickle in, however, one name that was mentioned piqued the interest of investigators. This was the name of local teenager, 18-year-old Andrew Dawson. Andrew Dawson was born in 1962 and raised in Ormskirk, living on Scott's estate with his parents and five other siblings. His family was just like any other, typical working class with quite a strict father. This is one of Andrew's older brothers, Mally, in a Criminal Minds episode briefly describing what it was like growing up in this household.
We were all brought up with the same treatment because my dad was a proper Victorian strict father. I mean, he didn't think nothing about giving you a slap, and I mean a good backhanded one. He was like, you always did as you were told.
From a young age, Andrew displayed very entitled tendencies. There was an instance when he was in primary school, so he'd have only been about 6 or 7 at the time, when he came across a younger girl. This younger girl was counting out some pennies that she had, literal brown pennies, and Andrew wanted them, so he pushed her over and snatched the coins from her hand before running away. This would reflect the mindset that Andrew held. If he wanted something, he had no issues in just taking it, especially if it was from someone that he considered weaker than himself. As he grew older, he would evolve into a petty criminal. He'd break into houses in and around the estate that he lived on and steal whatever he wanted from inside. More often than not, the occupants of these houses were elderly or vulnerable people. As a teen, Andrew began drinking alcohol and dabbling in different drugs. From 14, he was regularly using cannabis, eventually experimenting with magic mushrooms and glue. This, alongside his petty theft, made him a well-known name to authorities, who simply described him as a, quote, arrogant brass teenage yob. In general, Andrew Dawson was a universally disliked person. His friends feared him more than anything, and he was causing a lot of chew for his family. In fact, he had stolen money from Mally, his older brother, who confronted him and then reported the theft to the police. Following this arrest, Andrew was actually punished for once. He was sent to a borstal, which is just like another word for a youth prison, where he would stay for 6 months. Instead of knocking some fear into him or using this time to reflect on his actions and better himself, Andrew came out of the borstal worse than he had went in. On the 12th of August 1981, 18-year-old Andrew was in desperate need of some cash, which wasn't anything unordinary. He was always without money. It was another busy market day in Ormskirk as Andrew is walking down Moor Street. He arrived at the Yellow Hardware shop and creeped inside. Andrew knew Henry Walsh, and believing that a 91-year-old man wouldn't put up much of a fight, he decided that Henry would be the perfect victim to threaten for money, but he couldn't have been any more wrong. Andrew snuck up on Henry, pounced on him, and held him up against the door, demanding that he told him where the money was. Quick side note here, but Henry lived in the flat that was above the hardware shop, so it's likely that Andrew knew that there'd be money in the till, but it's assumed that Henry had more upstairs, and this is the money that Andrew is trying to coerce Henry into giving over. Using a knife, he would prod Henry to show him that he's serious. If he doesn't tell him where the money is, he will hurt him. But Henry refused to give in, and this is when Andrew begins to fatally stab Henry Walsh. After committing his first murder, Andrew didn't spiral into panic mode or even try and make a run for it. Instead, he cashed in Henry's pension and went to a pub just a couple of doors down from where he had displayed Henry's body on the back of a door and began playing on the fruit machines. When police put out their public appeal, a handful of the reports did point towards Andrew Dawson, partly because of his history, he is a career petty criminal, and partly because he had been spending so much money on the fruit machines. Andrew was normally a bit of a scrounger. He never had a penny to his name because he would always spend all of his money on drugs. So now, seeing him having enough money to not only buy himself his own drinks, but also play on the fruit machines, it stuck out like a sore thumb. Having no other viable leads, police arrested Andrew only a week after discovering Henry's body. During his questioning, he very quickly confessed, but tried to play it off as a crime in the moment, not a premeditated murder. His story was that he simply planned to rob Henry, but when Henry recognized him, knew his name, knew his face, it scared Andrew, so he killed Henry in order to silence him. Hearing this confession was genuinely a shock to the police and the investigators. They knew Andrew Dawson, and they knew him just to be a petty criminal who couldn't keep his hands to himself or keep his hands off other people's stuff, but they would have never considered that he could be such a violent criminal who would actually go and murder someone. The trial for the murder of Henry Walsh was held at Preston Crown Court in March 1982. Andrew Dawson would end up pleading guilty and was coming off remorseful. Within his statement, he apologised to the family of Henry and wished that it was himself dead instead of Henry. When passing down his sentence, the judge took this into account. Andrew was a young man, now 19, who seemed sorry for what he had done. He would be sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum of 14 years to serve. For lack of a better word, Andrew fooled the judge, who believed him to be remorseful. Who he didn't fool was his brother, Mally. Mally was inside the gallery studying his brother, and he would recall him having no emotion in his face, not distress, not a tear in his eye, that his words were just that. Words. From his time in the Borstal, he was able to pick up some other things from the other criminals in there, so he knew exactly what to say to get the result that he wanted. Mally did not believe that his brother was genuinely remorseful. During his incarceration, Andrew Dawson, 19-year-old, thought that he was the big man. He at one point had been in the same prison as infamous serial killer Peter Sutcliffe, also known as the Yorkshire Ripper, and also either Donald or Dennis Nilsen. Sources differ on which killer it was. He would describe these other murderers as wimps, saying that he wasn't impressed by them. He believed that he was a better killer than they were. What is going on in his psyche to make that comparison? Over the years, Andrew would participate in several learning and employability courses, and in 1999, at only 36, he was deemed suitable for release from Sudbury Prison. He had served 17 years for Henry Walsh's murder, and now he was a free man. The first couple of years of Andrew's release really couldn't have gone any better. He was abiding to his license terms, he found steady work and began getting into a typical stable working routine, which in turn helped him manage his alcohol addiction. He'd go to work Monday to Friday and then enjoy himself on the weekends. He would meet a beautiful dark-haired woman who he would fall in love with, and they would go on to marry, Mally being his best man at their wedding. The newlyweds would move to Derby together, where they settled down and began to grow their own family, having two lovely children. Andrew Dawson appeared to be a rehabilitated man, living a normal, stable, happy life, and his family were so proud of him. However, all good things must come to an end. I don't know what, if anything, triggered this, but Andrew would fall back into his old ways of abusing alcohol, which then spiraled into him getting back into drugs. This caused a financial strain and an emotional strain on his marriage, which by 2003 had completely broken down. His wife was no longer going to put up with what she was, and she wasn't having her children witness it neither, so she upped and she left Andrew. Over the next few years, Andrew would be in and out of prison for repeatedly breaching the terms of his license. He'd serve 3 months here, 6 months there. His longest serving time was a year. He had been caught sleeping on a bench and was in possession of a bladed article, which he wasn't allowed, so he was sent away for a year for that. He would continuously be released as somehow, despite his charges of murder, assault, violence, drunken and disorderly, possession of a knife, Andrew Dawson was considered a medium risk. Only a few years later, in hindsight, would the authorities realise just how wrong they were. The block of flats on Waterford Drive, Chadderton, Derbyshire, would have a new tenant move in early July 2010. This being 47-year-old Andrew Dawson. He had just been kicked out of another block of flats after he got into an altercation with the landlord. He was in rent arrears, so he hadn't been paying his rent, and then one of the other flats that the landlord owned was set on fire. The landlord believed that it was Andrew who had started the fire, so he went to confront Andrew about it, who initially profusely denied it, but then became violent with him, pushing him, wanting to start a fight. The landlord, however, didn't retaliate. Instead, he contacted the police, who arrested Andrew on suspicion of assault and arson. Residents of the Waterford Drive flats would take a liking to Andrew. Apparently, he could be all right when he wanted to be. A resident named Alan Cliff, who I am going to circle back to, so remember his name, described Andrew as a quote, "normal geezer, friendly, forward, and chatty." Within Andrew's new one-bedroom flat, he was having issues with his washing machine, so he relied on the help of a neighbour to wash his dirty clothes. This neighbour being 66-year-old John David Matthews, who went by Dave. Dave was originally from Belper, Derbyshire, and he lived alone in the Chadderton flat. Dave was more than happy to help Andrew with his washing. He was just natured like that, described as a friendly man who would do anything for anyone. He was the type of person who would give you his last penny. On the 10th of July, only days after moving in, Andrew arrived at Dave's flat, knocking on the door, using the rouse of needing help with washing to be let inside. Dave opened the door, smiled, and welcomed Andrew into his home. He turned around and began walking along the small hallway into his flat when, out of nowhere, bearing a knife, Andrew began to savagely stab Dave in a frenzy. Dave would sustain at least 18 wounds all across his chest and neck, leaving the hallway blood-soaked. Once confident that Dave was dead, Andrew stripped him, redressed him in fresh clothes, covering up his wounds, dragged his body into the bath, and then doused Dave in bleach. He would fill up the bath with water, adding in more bleach and some bubble bath for good measure, likely to try and eradicate some of the pending decomposition smell. Andrew then cleaned himself up, composed himself, and then went and spent the day out with his children. This was one of the few days that he was allowed to do something with them, unsupervised, I believe, and he decided to spend the morning committing a senseless, motiveless, unprovoked murder and then take the kids out on the afternoon. It was said that he was totally normal. You would have never guessed that he'd have done something as horrific as taken away a life only hours before. It was as if he had just switched off or had just clocked out from what he had done, and that's terrifying to me. The next day, Andrew would return to Dave's flat and began the long process of extensively cleaning it. On the 25th of July, police would receive a call from staff at Darley's restaurant, which is where Dave worked. He hadn't shown up to work in a week and he hadn't called ahead to tell his boss that he wouldn't be in. This was unusual as Dave had a really good work ethic, having worked all of his life. He was always punctual and kept his boss in the loop if and when he needed time off, so him being AWOL was totally out of character. Police arrived at the Chadderton flats to conduct a welfare check on the 66-year-old. They knocked on his door and waited and waited and waited, but no one was answering. They then made the decision to force entry into the flat, breaking down the door. This is when officers would discover the decomposing body of John David Matthews, still slumped in his bath. Officers' first impressions were that David had committed suicide. Again, Andrew had redressed him in fresh clothes, so none of his wounds were visible, and he, Andrew, had cleaned the flat so perfectly that it was described as pristine. There wasn't a single drop of blood or a thing out of place that would have suggested any sort of struggle or a murder taking place. The theory that Dave had committed suicide soon went out the window after his autopsy was conducted, the pathologist finding at least 18 stab wounds. It was estimated that Dave had been dead for around about 2 weeks, which would line up with his murder taking place on the 10th. This meant that Dave's killer was already 2 weeks ahead of police, so they needed to find him and apprehend them and do it before they struck again. The police had no way of knowing that they were already too late. Investigators began a murder investigation, and they started off by conducting door-to-door inquiries and gathering intelligence on everyone who lived inside of the flats. They were sure that the killer had to have been a resident, because from what I could gather, you needed like a fob key to get into the flats, or someone off the street couldn't have just walked in if they wanted, and Dave was someone who kept himself to himself, so it was unlikely that he had taken someone to the flat who ended up killing him. Combing through each of the residents and their backgrounds, there was one man who stuck out to officers. A man who had already served a life sentence for murder, a man who had since been in and out of prison, and of course, that man was Andrew Dawson. Police were keen to speak to him and they arrived to his flat knocking on the door. When he didn't answer, they forced entry inside, and it was clear that Andrew was long gone. His flat was spotless, the smell of bleach almost making the officers gag, and items including clothes and a large backpack were missing. Andrew Dawson was now on the run, and a manhunt to find him ensued. There was next to nothing of evidentiary value found inside of his flats or any of the flats really. Over 5,000 items were seized and examined, but there were only two things that aided in breaking the case open, which I'll delve into a little bit later. During the door-to-door inquiries, police spoke with Alan Cliff, the man who I briefly mentioned earlier. In the very short time that Andrew was at the flats, he and Alan had set the foundations of a friendship and they would drink together occasionally. Alan told the officers how within the past few days he had had an altercation with Andrew. Andrew arrived to his flat clearly frustrated and irritable, and he told Alan he just wanted to have a couple of beers and kick back with him. Andrew sat himself down and Alan went to retrieve something, glasses, beer, I'm not too sure, but when he came back into the room, he found Andrew rummaging around his stuff and he's like, "What are you doing?" Andrew would then jump up and get Alan into a headlock, wrapping one arm around Alan's neck and using his other arm to tighten the grip on the arm that is wrapped around Alan's neck. He then lifted Alan up from the ground by his neck, but thankfully, Alan was able to fight Andrew off of him. He started shouting at Andrew, giving it like, "What the fuck are you doing?" But Andrew brushed it off, saying it was just a bit banter, it was just a joke, but Alan didn't care and he ordered Andrew to leave, and so he did. Now, Alan was relatively different to Andrew's usual victims. He wasn't frail or vulnerable and was able to fight back, so he was probably shocked that Alan was able to shove him off of him. Could Alan have been a target, and could him shoving Andrew off and ordering him out of his flat saved his life? I think so. After ordering him away and slamming the door shut, Alan never saw Andrew again. Police went from tenant to tenant, speaking to each and everyone, apart from one man who wouldn't come to the door. On the 30th of July, police were once again forcing entry into a flat, this one being the flat of 58-year-old Paul Hancock. Paul, like Dave, was found deceased in his bath. His autopsy would show that he had died from blood loss after sustaining 22 stab wounds. Paul's niece would describe him in the most beautiful way, saying, quote, "He had a tenderness, even though he never had the chance to become a father. You never wanted to go up against him at Trivial Pursuit, as you always lost. He just appreciated the small things." Paul was described as an intelligent, gentle soul who was an admirer of art and loved to play the guitar. He had spent the past few years caring for his elderly mother, and he had once risked his own life running into a burning building to save a neighbour. Paul Hancock was a heroic man. Unlike Dave, Paul's flat was in disarray and did show signs of a struggle. Inside of the bleach-filled bath with his body, there were clothes and a knife. Some of the drawers inside of his flat had been opened and were still opened. They had very clearly been rummaged around in, and it appeared like it was money that had been stolen. But there had been some sort of effort to clear it up. The smell of bleach was clear evidence of that. As it turns out, Andrew had recently murdered Paul, and he was interrupted cleaning up the crime scene by police discovering the body of Dave. During their inquiries, Andrew was stood at the main door, and I believe this is just before they discovered Paul's body, when they're still trying to knock on the door and get him to come out. An officer there asked Andrew if he had heard or seen anything of Dave, to which he said that no, he hadn't, he didn't even really know him that well. Startled that the police were now on his tail, Andrew raced back to his flat, shoved a bunch of clothes and weapons into a backpack, and within 10 minutes, he had fled. Andrew Dawson, now officially a serial killer, jumped into a taxi to the train station, where CCTV would capture him boarding a train to Sheffield. He then made his way to Whitehaven, where he had family. This is Mally in a Criminal Minds episode recalling his drunk brother showing up to his house unexpectedly.
It was 9 o'clock, Robert De Niro film was just about to start, and there's a knock at the door. Open the door, slashing it down with rain, and I just went, "What do you want?" Not expecting to see him. I let him in. He put his bag down by the door, comes in, sat there like this. You could see by his eyes, all glazed. And he's rolling himself a joint. He's going on about his wife and his kids, and he can't see the kids anymore because his wife's had enough of him. He said, well, you remember a few years ago when I had to go back in for 12 months for carrying that knife? I went, "Yeah, what about it?" He said, "Well, I think I'll be going away again for a bit." "Oh, yeah, all right then."
So a few things happened in quick succession, so I'm sorry if I've had to go back and forth a bit in order for it to make sense. So it was on or around the 29th that investigators realised that Andrew was on the run, but it wasn't until the next day, the 30th, that they discovered Paul's body. But by this point, I know I'm jumping ahead a bit, but by this point Andrew had already been arrested. Once they realised he was on the run on the 29th, police notified all of the surrounding forces of Andrew's fleeing, and that they were on a manhunt to find him, believing he was armed and dangerous. Within only 3 hours of receiving this notice, police in Whitehaven managed to track down Andrew. He was asleep on a bench nearby the sea and wasn't really attempting to hide or conceal himself. When police attempted to arrest him, Andrew resisted, elbowing one of the officers in the face. He was actually able to give the officers the slip, and he decided that the best way to escape from them was to run into the ocean and swim away. He didn't get very far before he turned around and made his way back to shore. Using a taser gun for assistance, Whitehaven police were able to arrest Andrew Dawson on suspicion of murder at 6:30 a.m. on the 30th of July. Hours later, back in Derby, the body of Paul Hancock would be discovered. Inside of the backpack that he had with him, Andrew was carrying an array of weapons, including 7 knives, an axe, a hammer, gardening tools, and much more. It's absolutely terrifying to think about what he was intending to use those items for, how many other victims there may have been. Andrew was sent back to prison while investigators built their case. Because he was already on life license, they didn't have to abide to the 24-hour rule, so this gave them more time. As I mentioned, Andrew had cleaned down both of the flats with bleach, eradicating any forensic evidence. Dave's was tidier and more back to normal, whereas because he was interrupted during the cleanup of Paul's flat, his was still messier. However, like I say, both flats forensically had been completely wiped down, not leaving a single trace behind, which of course made this very hard for investigators. As of right now, there was no evidence linking Andrew to these murders. In the bleach bath with Paul, there were weapons and items of clothing, including some yellow marigold kitchen gloves. This would explain why Andrew's fingerprints were nowhere to be found. One of the thumb fingers of the gloves had the smallest tear at the tip, and Paul's flat was turned upside down to try and find it, and finally, they did. It's believed that the tip of the glove had been torn off as Andrew was rummaging around in the drawers. This was carefully collected and sent off for DNA analysis. Investigators holding their breath while awaiting the results. Back in Andrew's flat, there was little to no evidence. There was a notebook which had been written in, but the pages with the writing on had been ripped out. The book was sent off for forensic analysis to see if experts could examine the indentations from the pen and work out what had been wrote inside. These two pieces of evidence out of the 5,000 that were collected would be the ones to break the case wide open. It took 3 weeks for the notebook to be forensically examined, but they managed to work out what Andrew had wrote down. With many spelling mistakes and capital letters dotted all over, there was a written confession. It read, quote, "To head of homicide, I want to confess to a murder. I stabbed a man to death. A man lies in a bath of water," and then he adds the letters O-W-V-E-R on the end of water, so water over. He continues, "Two major wounds to his left side, maybe two to his chest, one to his back, to the base of his neck. This is no hoax," he writes in capital letters. "If you don't find him in a week, I will give you his address. The pink rose was a nice touch." And then he signed it, "The Angel of Mercy." Reading this was chilling to the investigators. Andrew had not only confessed, but he knew the method of murder, that the victims had been stabbed. He knew the victims were in a bath, but he also knew a detail that was never made public knowledge. Inside of John's bedroom, placed on a pillow, was a small fake pink rose. It stood out to the investigators because it was so out of place. Like, what was it doing there? They couldn't figure it out, but now they knew. DNA analysis of the torn tip of that yellow glove came back. They were able to extract a full DNA profile from the tiniest little bit of glove, and that DNA was a perfect match to Andrew Dawson. His trial was held at Nottingham Crown Court in July 2011, where he entered a plea of not guilty. After a couple of hours of sitting through the court proceedings and hearing what great, overwhelming evidence there was against him, Andrew Dawson would change his plea to guilty. He couldn't be bothered to sit through the whole trial when he knew that he couldn't worm or manipulate his way out of it. At the sentencing for the murders of John David Matthews and Paul Hancock, Andrew Dawson would receive a whole life order. This means that he will spend the rest of his natural life behind bars. He will never live another free day for the rest of his life. Older brother Mally shares his thoughts, saying, quote, "I think he will take himself out, or he will try and do one of the other inmates. He is pure evil, a total psycho. If the government would like to appoint me as an official hangman, I, and other members of my family, come to think of it, would gladly put the noose around his neck and then pull the lever. He should suffer, because that evil devil deserves no less. I would not lose sleep over it. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, please make sure to leave me a nice review and to follow the podcast wherever you're listening. I would appreciate that so much. You can follow the podcast over on Instagram at True Crime Caitlin Pod, where I'll be uploading images relating to all of the cases and for